everybody. Welcome back to the show. This is Mark Ceffardini, your host of the Go See Talk podcast experience. We are thrilled beyond belief to be speaking to an animated Dynamo duo. Duo Dynamo, not sure how it goes, but they made one hell of a movie. The Spine of Night is something that you've never seen before, unless you look over Morgan King's shoulder and see that heavy metal poster on his wall. Either way, it's adult animation at its finest. Guys, thank you so much for joining the podcast. How did that go with Telluride?
Oh yeah, well thanks so much for having us. Telluride, we went to the Telluride Horror Show, and it was amazing. We've been in a ton of festivals this year. So we premiered at South by Southwest, but it's been all over the world. But obviously, because of COVID, we haven't really felt like we should travel to all of those places. So this is the first one that we met up and saw with a live audience together in person. So it was a amazing bookend to this long festival season.
Yeah, it was pretty exciting. It is much different to see the movie with a bunch of people who have never seen it before. You really appreciate it, it's nerve-wracking, but really exciting when it works and you can like feel the reaction. So cool. Yeah.
Well, I think I was remiss to actually announce you guys. Morgan King, Philip Gelott are the dynamos I aforementioned. One of the difficult things about being in the creative process is that, the blank canvas syndrome, how do you persevere? If I get the math right, this was a 7-year endeavor. How do you just keep that fire burning when you want to see it finished?
Oh, I mean, sheer madness, I think. I don't think there's no rational person would ever embark on something like this. But in terms of like the blank page, the flip side of that is that it takes so long to do each thing. Like the short films I did before, were all many months long, 3 to 10 months each. So, there's a lot of time to really think about what kind of stories you would tell next and what kind of blank pages you would fill in. So that part came pretty easy, but the long animation cycle was grueling, but also you enter just a fugue state. You have no other choice but to accomplish it at some point. You've spent 3.5-4 years and you still have 3 to go. You can't really give up. So
on that note, as you're working with people, I was reading that you had 3 key animators over the whole course of the production, and I guess being the creative forces behind this, you have a stake. But how do you get people all? Where do you find these 3 key players, and how do you keep them retained for so long?
Well, it was the first 2 years were spent almost exclusively trying to train people in this ostensibly dead art form, and it them being burned out very quickly within a shot or two. Like it is, it asks a lot of anyone, and it's, it just takes longer than almost any other form of hand-drawn animation. So it was tough to find the core team. We got Ian Densford early on, and he made it like 3 years, I think. And then this guy Britt Scott was with us almost the entire time.
He a true hero, Britt Scott. This is the first time we got to talk about him in an interview, but man, what a champion.
He's an absolute trooper. And then when my brother's wife became pregnant with his now a very grown child, he wanted to be able to spend more time at home. And he had an animation background but wasn't working in animation. And he was like, can I work on your film? And I was like, I would absolutely love this because I can bully him as much as an older brother needs to whip him into shape and force him to do it. But then he rose to the challenge, and beyond any sort of nepotism, he's just wildly talented. So
he and Britt went on to work on For Minnow Mountain. They animate Undone, the Amazon series. So a couple of our guys, went on to work on that, which is pretty cool. So.
Well, how do you guys split your time and responsibilities? Because Philip, I've seen, I love Death and Robots. And each of those is such a, we're here to talk about Spine of Night. We can have another conversation.
How do you split your
responsibilities, and how do you work with the different, the voice actors, the animators, the sound editors?
Yeah, so the split was, at the beginning, we were really doing everything together. So we co-wrote it together when we did the live action reference for the motion capture, for the the animation, the live action reference. We did all that together in a warehouse, and we really were sort of, you know, co-directing the actors and doing all that together. At which point, and then we edited the live action version together. All of that was very much a 50-50 collaboration. At that point, things split a bit because I can't even draw a stick figure, so I can't draw. I could have tried. At one point, I was like, maybe I should help color, but I probably would have screwed that up too. So when the animation process started, that was largely Morgan's world. So I would come in and offer notes or guidance, or when there were background painters, I would sort of, you know, I would help find them and hire them and bring them on board and offer any kind of creative insight that I could. But a lot of that was Morgan's department, almost entirely. And then later on, I worked most closely with the sound designers, but of course, as with the animation and me, with the sound work and Morgan, he was providing notes and guidance and all that kind of stuff. And then the voice actors, that was largely me again doing, you know, directing them and bringing them into the process. So it worked out, I mean, much harder on Morgan because it was 7 years of him just drawing it while I was off, you know, flitting about and writing Love, Death, and Robots and things. But I don't know. I mean, it was a great, from my perspective, a fantastic collaboration. I really, you know, I did love it. So.
Well, great. You know, you mentioned the voice acting, and I think you look at Richard E. Grant and Patton Oswalt, Lucy Lawless. It's a very unexpected mix of characters. So what about each of them felt right? And a quick follow-up to that, if it sounded like you used Patton Oswalt for some additional voices, am I just imagining that, or did you try to get more out of his paycheck?
No, he is only that character. There are a couple other voices in there that I suspect you think might be him, but no, he really is just his character. Just his one, his one simpering king character. You know, we started the voice casting process by trying to pick people that were both well suited for the part, but also either self-identified nerds or came from nerd world, right? So Joe Manganiello, being the first person we approached, he has a self-avowed love of D&D and he loves dark fantasy art. So and he's perfectly suited for that barbarian character. So we started with him, and then Lucy, I mean, she's you know, genre royalty, and she is as not just genre royalty, but she is not what's the term, she's crazy in a very wonderful, charismatic way. And by that I mean, I think a lot of actresses would have seen the way that character is drawn. I mean, her character is fully naked the whole movie and not drawn in a sort of traditional, overly sexualized fantasy art way. I think a lot of actresses, even if they liked the part, would have been like, I don't want people to see me in that role. Lucy was like, oh, I definitely want people to see me. You know, I love this. I love the way she's drawn. I love that she's, you know, not a warrior, but is still strong and really embraced the part in a way that was really incredible. Richard E. Grant, I am still shocked that he came to do our movie because I have loved him for forever. I mean, just amazing. It was a really exciting moment when he said he would come on and voice that part. I said in my, you know, like I wrote a letter to all of them as that we offered them the part. And I referenced Hudson Hawk in my letter to Richard E. Grant, which is a movie that I don't want to say I'm the only human being who loves that movie, but it's probably a very short list.
There's
there's like six of us, and we meet every night to confess our movie sins. So I mentioned it to him in that letter. I know that he hates that movie himself, so I don't know if that was the smartest thing to do, but he took the part, so it's fine.
Well, great. You know, it's funny. I couldn't even tell that was Lucy voicing it. You know, with Patton, you kind of know who that was, and same with Richard. But it's nice how characters just, they didn't appear to just be a surrogate of themselves. They actually, you know, did something different. And more to that point, different is grotesque and violent and ultra. I mean, like, where did you draw the line on the animation, Morgan? And it's like, what did you try for that you were really hoping to get and you nailed it?
There is no line.
Yeah, I mean, we really worked with no, I mean, we just did whatever felt true to each shot. You know, when you're working frame by frame, there's some level of nudity detail that we were like, I was like, I'm not going to draw that. That would have been present. But for the most part, we you know, it was uncensored in the sense that we just did what was true to the film. Like, what did each shot call for? There's something about like really sterilized violence that feels like it's undercutting what is happening to me. Like, you know, I often think of like watching G.I. Joe as a kid, you know, and they shoot the jets down and everybody has a parachute, you know, like it's like a bloodless war. And so I didn't want this film to act as like, I don't know, like I think of it as not a film that it condemns violence in a lot of ways. I think it has fun with it in a horror movie sense, like an Evil Dead gore sense. But I didn't want, like, narratively the violence to be without horrific stakes. I mean, you know, stabbing someone or chopping their head with an axe should be gruesome.
Yeah. Well, the one that did it for me was, and I hope this isn't spoiling anything, but there's a fight somewhere, and when the lava pool... Just, oh, that made my insides cringe. So you
Morgan,
guys
talk about the tooth, Morgan.
Oh yeah, that's also it's my favorite too. Yep. the wave there is a homage to the raft sequence from Creepshow 2. Anyway, but I grind my teeth when I sleep, and this is something I've been trying to deal with for, I don't know, forever. At least since we've been working on this project, I started grinding my teeth.
Coincidence. Totally a coincidence.
Total coincidence. But that same tooth I've worn down. But if you watch that one frame by frame, it's his jaw, as he's being melted, his teeth grind in a very particularly gnarly way. There's a lot of gross stuff if you go through it frame by frame, which I hope someone will do someday.
Yeah. Well, I have to ask a kind of dumb question, but what is the most difficult thing, whether historically or current days, what's the most difficult thing about rotoscoping, and is it the teeth?
I mean, there's a lot of design philosophy about what to do with the teeth. I think a lot about teeth because you have to draw them so much. And like a lot of styles like this don't draw the lines between the individual teeth. But I guess I think it just adds a naturalism to it, like where everyone doesn't have perfect Hollywood polished teeth in this, you know, gruesome medieval setting. So I don't know. I look at human beings out in the wild and I spend probably a creep about it now. I just stare at everyone's face and think about how I'd rotoscope them. But like, you know, I think a lot about their teeth and people have weird teeth. And
I've got very weird teeth. I've got this gap in my teeth that's I think it's gotten wider since I've gotten older. Shouldn't talk about that on a podcast, but it's true.
Yeah. So that was, I could talk about like the aesthetics of teeth and animation at great length, but I won't bore you with it.
That'll be our next podcast.
Yeah.
Teeth talk. Yeah.
You know, I have to say the most rewarding part of the movie was when you learn of the history of how the bloom came to Earth or the planet, this world. And that's where I think you took what felt like Franz Frazetta. It felt familiar to a certain point, and that's when you took it to another level. And I have to ask, how do you come up with the philosophy or the science behind how much of the leaf does something, what the leaf does in fire, how it reacts differently for different people? Like, what were some of the discussions you had?
I mean, I've always thought about it sort of as like it's a focus point as much as a thing that's inherently powerful, that it's almost like what you channel, like, magical thinking through.
Well, I mean, I believe the line in the movie is whatever you dream you will have, which is what the villain says to one of the other villains. Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
So it's like a magic item in as much as it is what everyone believes is magical, if that makes sense. And philosophically, I mean, I think it's just like a lifetime of trying to be introspective and thinking about, you know, politics and, you know, existentialism and, you know, how we exist in the world and like the myths we tell and the way we use those myths to create the power structures that our world is built around. And then to figure out how to reverse engineer that and explain it in a fantasy cosmology setting.
And also, I think one of the benefits of it is the sort of when things are nebulous and they don't have a definition or an answer, makes it much more like, again, heavy metal behind you. What was that green orb? And it was different things to different people. And so that's what I found pretty interesting. But now to wrap this up, maybe can you talk about the costumes? I thought that, you know, they were very intricate, and even things like the way that I'm going to say his name wrong, but the librarian who uses little tongs to turn the pages. It seems so inventive to me. You know, where did all that come from, and how much fun did you have creating these things?
I think it's so hard to know where ideas come from, but I mean, certainly there's a lot of intentional design decisions, like where we'd start. I mean, the costuming is not something I specifically have a background in, but you know, I did graphic design for a long time before this. And so thinking about like thematic design elements, like where you'd start with, like, I think you can see the same shapes, like the order of the librarians as they go through time. Like, I try to retain visual elements, and then like you can see the, as we jump through the centuries, the armors develop and modernize along like cultural aesthetic lines. For the finger cloths, I was on drugs, and I thought this would be really cool. Yeah. And because
your answer. It's drugs.
but like, they used to be, when we wrote this, they hadn't figured out what these things were. They thought they were page turners, for like monks would use them to turn pages of old books. And it turns out that's not actually what they were. They were paper knives, because the old pages wouldn't always be cut, so you could get to every page when you would open up a new book. So they would use those to cut each page as they flip through the book. But so we use them both as knives and as page turners.
That's awesome. You know, it kind of reminded me, there was an episode of The Simpsons where Bart and Milhouse, they share a comic book. And there's a part where they're turning the pages with the tweezers. And I was like, well, maybe but
no doubt. I've seen that episode 100 times, so I'm sure that's in my brain somewhere.
Well, last question, and not to do a spoiler, but one of the things that sort of affected me was the ending. You know, you have this, there's an eventuality to the characters and the storyline, and it felt like, were you trying to piss people off at the end? Were you trying to tell us that if you don't do wrong, won't have wrong put on you, or just there's no way to get away from the chaos of the universe?
I'd say it's more the latter. I don't think either of us are particular moralists in a good and evil sense. No. But I mean, I think, yeah, the universe is is a chaotic engine built on death and cycles of rebirth, you know? So I think that's, I think we're very much getting at not satisfying the heroic narratives. I think at pretty much every turn when we set up a hero, it's more like when you think you're gonna take a baseball bat and fight Jason Voorhees and you're going to lose. You know, like that heroism is often in fantasy fiction in a way that I find really unsatisfying. Like, I think almost always you're going to a difficult, dangerous place, and it almost always means very little once the story zooms out and it's not about the hero, but about the world.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with all that. I also think it is sort of an obvious observation, but recently I suddenly realized that like no American movies made now have endings that are anything less than happy endings, you know, and I just don't like that. I mean, I've written plenty of happy endings, but my favorite endings, and I wouldn't say this is a unhappy ending, I would say that it is a ambiguous ending. I've described the ending as hopefully apocalyptic, but it's not, again, no spoiler alert, it's not like, and then the heroes ride off into the sunset because the bad guy has been defeated. And I think, not to be pedantic towards American pop culture, but I think it's just not the type of ending that people are used to getting, in especially in their genre fiction. And I anticipate probably people will be pissed off, although that was not the intention. I find it a very creatively satisfying ending, but I get that people might blanch at it. So, yeah.
Well, I meant the question in jest, but I love the answer or response from both of you guys. Okay, well, hey, absolute congratulations on this. This hit me in my my 8-year-old body, because I love the sorcery world as well. But guys, best of luck to you, and I hope to talk soon.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you so much.
This has been wonderful. Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Take care.